Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. Soon, 1 month and a half. I won't have to say that catchphrase anymore. I have to come up with a new one. Okay, before I jump into chapter 17 of book 14, I'll just apologize for my voice. I have some kind of head cold, hay fever maybe, and I am really stuffy, so I apologize for that. Luckily, it's a very short chapter, so you won't have to put up with my nasally voice for too long. The movements of the Russian and French armies during the campaign from Moscow back to the Niemen were like those in a game of Russian blind man's buff, in which two players are blindfolded and one of them occasionally rings a little bell to inform the catcher of his whereabouts. First, he rings his bell fearlessly, but when he gets into a tight place, he runs away as quietly as he can and, often thinking to escape, runs straight into his opponent's arms. At first, while they were still moving along the Kaluga Road, Napoleon's armies made their presence known. But later, when they reached the Smolensk Road, they ran, holding the clapper of their bell tight, and often thinking that they were escaping, ran right into the Russians. Owing to the rapidity of the French flight and the Russian pursuit, and the consequent exhaustion of the horses, the chief means of approximately ascertaining the enemy's position by cavalry scouting was not available. Besides, as a result of the frequent and rapid change of position by each army, even what information was obtained could not be delivered in time. If news was received one day that the enemy had been in a certain position the day before, by the third day, when something could have been done, that army was already 2 days' march farther on and in quite another position. One army fled, and the other pursued. Beyond Smolensk, there were several different roads available for the French, and one would have thought that during their stay of 4 days they might have learned where the enemy was, might have arranged some more advantageous plan, and undertaken something new. But after 4 days' halt, the mob, with no manoeuvres or plans, again began running along the beaten track, neither to the right nor the left, but along the worst road, through Krasnoye and Orsha. Expecting the enemy from behind and not in front, the French separated in their flight and spread out over a distance of 24 hours. In front of them all fled the Emperor, then the kings, then the dukes. The Russian army, expecting Napoleon to take the road to the right beyond the Dnieper, which was the only reasonable thing for him to do, themselves turned to the right and came out onto the high road at Krasnoye. And here, as in a game of blind man's buff, the French ran into our vanguard. Seeing their enemy unexpectedly, the French fell into confusion and stopped short from the sudden fright, but then they resumed their flight, abandoning their comrades who were further behind. Then, for 3 days, separate portions of the French army, first Murat's, the vice-kings, then Davout's, then Ney's, ran, as it were, the gauntlet of the Russian army. They abandoned one another, abandoned all their heavy baggage, their artillery and half their men, and fled, getting past the Russians by night by making semicircles to the right. Ney, who came last, had been busying himself blowing up the walls of Smolensk, which were in nobody's way, because despite the unfortunate plight of the French, or because of it, they wished to punish the floor against which they had hurt themselves. Ney, who had had a corps of 10,000 men, reached Napoleon at Orsha with only 1,000 men left, having abandoned all the rest and all his cannon, and having crossed the Dnieper at night by stealth at a wooded spot. From Orsha they fled farther along the road to Vilna, still playing at blind man's bluff with the pursuing army. At the Burezina they again became disorganized. Many were drowned and many surrendered, but those who got across the river fled farther. Their supreme chief donned a fur coat and, having seated himself in a sledge, galloped on alone, abandoning his companions. Those others who could do so drove away too, leaving those who could not to surrender or die. All right, there we go, another chapter down. The French are well and truly on their way out of Russia. I'll keep this short because I am struggling a bit with my speaking. Kansas 57 said, "How do you like Tolstoy's comparison of the end of the war to a blind man's bluff? Do you think it fully encompasses the situation?" De Fleury said, "Today is one of those days I'd characterize this novel as dull and depressing, and maybe because I imagine playing blind man bluff, Russian style, in an open field, so we don't damage the furniture. But the odds must be 1,000 to 1. There's really no chance of ending the game until the bell guy stands still and rings to indicate surrender. What a moronic game. At least the Russian style of roulette doesn't take all day." It occurs to me the earlier war chapters were more fun than now. Even though theoretically we won and the book should be happy, instead I am tired of suffering. JMama8779 said, "In the earlier chapters, the war was more robotic and without emotion. As the novel progressed, war, for what it is, started to show its true face. We're really seeing it now in these chapters." Blind Man's Bluff, by the way, or traditionally it was called Blind Man's Buff, is a variant of tag in which the player who is it is blindfolded. The traditional name of the game is Blind Man's Buff, where the word buff is used in its older sense of a small push. There you go, I had to look that up because I wasn't sure what blind man's bluff was. They're feeling around in the dark. It's hopeless. Alright, I'm going to wrap it up there because I cannot breathe properly. Sorry for today's terrible voice. Hopefully by tomorrow I'm all cleared up. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.